system. It's counting. I mean, we're live. Okay. The Environment, Energy, and Natural Resources Budget Division will come to order. Welcome, everyone. We're going to continue with our overview of the governor's budget proposal first, and then we'll take any public testimony or feedback on that budget, and then a couple of bills. We'll just be going in the order on the agenda. So we'll start with the Public Utilities Commission. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Burl Haar. I'm the Executive Secretary for the Commission. I'm here to do a brief overview of the Governor's Supplemental Budget Proposal as it pertains to the PUC. If you bear with me, I'll just give you a little brief background on the program that's affected by this proposal. The proposal is to transfer funds from the telephone special revenue fund for the telephone assistance plan, the general fund. Telephone assistance plan is a program that occurs under Minnesota Statute Chapter 237.69 to 237.711. The program provides a monthly credit against phone bills for households that meet certain income criteria. The program is funded by a surcharge on local telephone company access lines, which is paid by ratepayers. TAP program parallels the federal Lifeline program, which also provides a credit, similar credit, and also the Lifeline program establishes eligibility criteria used in the state program. The Commission has authority to establish both the TAP credit that households receive as well as the surcharge that ratepayers pay. Currently, the monthly TAP credit is $1.75 per household, and the monthly surcharge is 2 cents per access line. Till last March, the Commission had had in place a surcharge of 5 cents per access line. That surcharge level had actually been in place for a number of years, and over time had gradually generated more revenue than needed for the program. However, there were some changes being made at the federal level that would have affected eligibility here at the state level. And even though the Commission considered making some changes to bring down the balance, it refrained from doing so until the federal guidelines had been established. Last March, after that had occurred, after the federal guidelines had been clarified, the Commission moved to draw down the fund balance, chose to do so by reducing revenues rather than changing the benefits received by households. As I said, reduced the surcharge from 5 cents to 2 cents. The effect of this change is to reduce the fund balance by about $950,000 a year based on current access line counts and household enrollment. The plan of the Commission is to draw down the balance over a period of 3 to 4 years, and then it would have to reestablish a surcharge level on the program going forward. And given, as I said, given the current enrollment and access line counts, it would probably have to reestablish a 5 cent surcharge at some point in the future. Currently, the program, the expenditures under the program are about $1.7 million. Again, that's based on a $1.75 monthly credit and current enrollment levels. Expected revenues with the 2 cent surcharge is $750,000. So you can see that the expenditure levels are just shy of $1 million annually, and that's what's bringing the fund balance down over time. Fund balance currently is about $5.2 million, and the expectation was that it would take about 3 to 4 years to bring that balance down into a more reasonable range. The governor's proposal would transfer from the special revenue fund would draw down the fund by the end of this fiscal year. In other words, the governor's proposal would bring about in 1 year what the commission had intended to do in the course of a couple of years.
Dr. Haar, can you move your microphone a little closer?
I'm sorry.
You're fading in and out.
I'm sorry. Thank you. The proposed $4 million transfer would bring the fund balance at the end of this fiscal year down to about 200,000 and would necessitate the commission reconsidering and adjusting the TAP surcharge to a level that would be needed to fund the program going forward. Exactly what that level would be, I couldn't say for sure at this point, but my guess is it would be in the 5-cent range. So that's the extent of my comments. I'd be happy to try and answer any questions you might have.
Okay, thank you. I'm trying to kind of catch up with you here. So the current surcharge, again, is what?
Current surcharge is 2 cents. It had been 5 cents for quite a number of years. And the commission was aware that there was a surplus balance in the fund and had intentions of bringing that down. But as I mentioned, there were some changes being made with the federal program that would have affected eligibility in the state program. And until those federal changes were clarified, the commission felt it was better just to wait. Last March, the FCC acted and the guidelines were changed, and therefore the commission decided to bring the fund balance down by reducing the revenues.
Okay, Dr. Hart, I apologize for I've been a little distracted here. So to get up to the when would it have to go up to the 5 cent range, do you think?
Well, as I said, the $4 million transfer, if it were to occur this year as part of this bill, would bring the balance down to the area of $200,000 balance in the fund. So the commission would very likely need to address the surcharge issue prior to July 1st to have that in place going forward. So commission would need to consider that sometime probably in the May-June timeframe.
So so you have the authority to change that fee without legislation?
Madam Chair, that's correct. The statute allows the commission to set a surcharge up to 10 cents per access line. As I said, it initially was set at 10 cents back when the program was started, but it's been coming down.
Okay, so you think by this year you'd have to raise it, and how much? How much is the ongoing expenditure? $1 million?
At this point, the current level of activity, we estimated at around $1.7 million. It fluctuates, Madam Chair, over time depending upon enrollment and so on, but it's range from a 0.4 to around now 1.7 million over the last couple of years.
Okay, and if you raised it to 5 cents, how much would you bring in, roughly?
That would generate approximately right around 1.6 million, I believe. Again, if the current, it just depends on what we expect enrollment to be and what we expect access line counts to be, and so on. It all depends on that, and we try and use the most recent information to make those estimates.
It's 2 cents now. Okay. Okay. So.
2 cents, knowing they have a surplus to spend.
I see. Okay.
We have to jump right back up.
So the rate. So if so 5 cents is kind of a sustainable fee for the. At least the immediate future?
Madam Chair, I believe it is. That's just my judgment. It had been the surcharge that the commission had in place for quite a number of years prior to last March when it brought the rate down. So it's been a rate that we've had in place for some time, and it sustained the program going forward at that point. What happened initially, and this may be more history than you want, but what happened initially was when the program was created, the commission established the surcharge at 10 cents, just at the maximum, because we weren't sure what the enrollment was going to be. And a surplus built up in that. But as I said, there were changes that were occurring at the federal level that left in question what our requirements would be, so it was always kind of in flux. Now we have a better idea of what our requirements are. We believe we have a pretty good estimate as to the probable level of enrollment over the coming years. We think that's a fairly stable number now. Before, it could potentially have fluctuated depending upon the criteria that the federal government set. So we think things have sort of stabilized now, and numbers are a little more certain.
So, Dr. Haar, so we're talking about, so how long, I'm sorry, maybe you just said this. I keep getting distracted. I apologize. I'm trying to deal with other things at the same time. So how long has it been 5 cents?
Madam Chair, didn't go back and look at that, but I believe that's probably been in place for at least, that charge was in a place for at least maybe 4 years, 5 years,
okay.
Something in that area.
Okay.
It
and
had
then,
been 6 cents for a while before that, but as I said, it had gradually been.
And reducing it to 2 cents, that was because you mentioned something about a federal change, and I didn't quite follow that. Was that
right? We were aware that the fund had a surplus balance. We had more money in the fund than we needed for the program. We got a $5.2 million balance. We really only need about $1.7 million, $1.8 million. To fund the program, but the state eligibility is tied to the federal eligibility, and the federal Lifeline program was undergoing some changes. And there was some discussion about changing the eligibility criteria, broadening it basically, and we felt the enrollment here could have gone from 64,000 where it is right now as high as 150,000 depending upon how they set those criteria. So the commission was leery about changing anything until we knew for sure what those criteria were going to be. And as I said, as of about a year ago, those were established, and we felt we could move forward, and the commission moved to try and address the surplus.
So, okay. All right. So, so basically, we could. We could use the surplus to fund this for the next two to three years, I guess. Otherwise, we have to increase this fee if we take the $4
million. No, Madam Chair, the transfer, $4 million, would bring the fund balance down to about $200,000 at the end of this fiscal year.
Oh, so that's too much.
So the commission, before the end of this fiscal year, would have to take measures to increase that surcharge so we'd have enough revenues to fund the program going forward, and we would fully intend to do that, but that's what would have to happen. So it would be a one-time transfer, basically.
Right. So we're talking, okay, but I'm just trying to understand in terms of the governor's budget, it would require a 3 cents per telephone user fee increase.
Madam Chair, it would require an increase. Exactly what it would be would depend on sort of what we project the enrollment to be and access lines to be. I believe it would be probably in the 3 cent range, but for sure I don't know at this point. It would all depend on the evidence that we have at that time.
So, but if we were to take, I guess you said the 2 cents isn't going to get us there. So even if we kept some of the money in the fund to avoid a fee increase, a $1-point-some-million fee increase this year, if that surplus won't last forever at the current rate.
Madam Chair, that's correct. Even under the commission's approach, which would have brought the fund down more gradually,
okay,
commission would have had to increase that surcharge at
eventually
some point. So, yes.
All right. I think I've got it. Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Senator? No? Okay. And that's all you have in your budget change items?
That's all I have, Madam
Great.
Chair.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Next, we're going to hear from Arnie Steffarud with Metro Parks.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Arnie Steffarud. I'm a park planning analyst at the Metropolitan Council, and I'm here today to present the Governor's budget recommendations for Metropolitan Regional Parks operations and maintenance. My PowerPoint show is in your packet as well, since some of my slides will be rather detailed. The topics I want to cover today are first to summarize what the park system is and the agencies that operate and maintain it, plus past state funding of operations and maintenance, and then I'll represent the governor's supplemental budget reduction recommendation. In regards to the park system, the Metro Council is required by state law to designate county and city and special park district lands, which consist of 52,600 acres, and those are available for outdoor recreation and environmental education use. They complement the state park system. There are 44 regional parks ranging in size from 200 to 500 acres. There's a couple of exceptions of 100-acre parks. They're similar to state recreation areas. There are 13 park reserves ranging in size from 1,000 to 5,000 acres, and they're similar to state parks. There's over 170 miles of trails linking these parks together, and those are comparable to state trails. And finally, there are six special recreation features that provide unique outdoor recreation and environmental education facilities. There were 33.2 million visits to the park system in 2006. Only the Mall of America has more annual visits than the regional park system. The park system is owned and managed by 10 regional park agencies. The council doesn't own any of this property. It just provides grants to these agencies for capital improvements and for operations and maintenance. Most of these agencies also own and manage non-regional park facilities that just serve neighborhoods. Those local parks are not part of the regional park system. Since 1985, Minnesota state law has required the council to distribute state funds for operations and maintenance to these park agencies according to the formula shown on this slide. 40% is based on each agency's proportional regional system visits. We do estimated visits counts every year. 20% is based on each agency's proportion of regional park system acreage that they manage. Natural resource lands and park reserves, however, are divided by four. 40% is based on each agency's amount of spending or their share of the park system in the previous capital or previous calendar year. Since fiscal year 1986, the state has, as I said, partially financed the cost to operate and maintain the park system. Those state funds are distributed based on the formula I've just described. The red area on this slide represents the state funds appropriated since fiscal year 86 to the present and includes the governor's recommended cut for fiscal year 2009. The green area represents the total expenses to operate and maintain the park system from fiscal year 86 to the present. On average, state funds have financed about 9.4% of the total cost to operate and maintain the park system. The growth in total O&M expenses of 7.3% is due to increased park user revenues, visitation growth, as well as additional property tax revenues from new development in the region.
Mr. Stafford, can you move your microphone close? I'm sorry, they don't carry very far.
Okay. There are two state revenue sources that are used to finance operations and maintenance, and they are the general fund and a portion of lottery revenues collected in lieu of sales tax. The lottery in lieu of sales tax appropriation is dedicated for this purpose by state law. The governor recommends that 4% or $162,000 of the general fund appropriation for fiscal year 2009 be cut to help balance the budget. No reduction is proposed in the lottery in lieu of sales tax appropriation. So as this slide illustrates, the $8,620,000 appropriation for fiscal year 2008 would be cut $162,000 to $8,458,000 in 2009. So the net reduction is 1.88%. Here's the estimated amount that would be cut from each park agency's appropriation based upon that $162,000 fund reduction. This estimate is based upon visitation, acreage, and expenditure data used last year. The actual amount of the cuts will be based on updated visitation, acreage, and expenditure data. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you very much, Mr. Steffrud. I think it's always good to remind remind the committee about, you know, the Metro Park system is funded. There's a small portion of state funding, but the vast majority of the funding comes from local taxpayers. Maybe you could give us that information about how much the percent and the dollar amount that comes from local versus state.
Well, Madam Chair and members, this slide illustrates that fairly well. As you see, the red portion is the state's appropriations in the past, including what's been recommended for fiscal year 08-09. And the green portion is total expenditures. What's funded, or the revenue for the green portion, if you will, on this slide is user revenues and local property tax revenues.
So in dollars, what's the, can you compare?
Roughly for the biennium, it would be $160 million. That would be the total expenditure for operations and maintenance, and about $16 million would come from the state, or a little less than 10%.
Okay, and is that before or after the governor's proposed cut?
That would be including the governor's proposed cut. $162,000, as I said, is 1.8% of the total state's appropriation. So I'm giving you ballpark numbers.
All right. And I always use Como Park as my example because I think everyone's familiar with Como Park. And Como Park in particular, we have over 80% of the visitors are from outside our city. So less than 20% are actually from St. Paul. And city taxpayers pick up more than 90% of the bill for that park. And so we're glad to do it. We love having the park in our community, but we need state support. We rely on it for those millions and millions of visitors. And I think the Metro Parks are actually seriously underfunded and supported by the state already. So I don't like this cut. Any other questions? All right. Thank you so much. All right. Now we've asked for any public response or testimony on the governor's budget recommendations. And we've got a few people who have signed up. First, Michael Schmidt from the Minneapolis Park Board. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senators. My name is Michael Schmidt, and I'm the General Manager with the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board. I've been there for 28 years. As Mr. Steffrud talked about, we are one of the implementing agencies with the Metropolitan Park System, and that's made up of different organizations, county governments, city governments, and separate governmental agencies. Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board happens to be one of those separate special park districts or separate governmental agencies. Within Minneapolis, we have approximately 14 million visits each year to the Minneapolis Regional Park System. So as we talked about, that the Regional Park System is second only to Mall of America in terms of tourist visits to the Metropolitan or to Minnesota. Within that, Minneapolis receives the lion's share of those visits in terms of 14 million visits. We happen to be in the middle of the population base for the regional area, and As you pointed out, Madam Chair, Minneapolis taxpayers are the ones that fund a significant portion of what it really costs to run the regional park system. We are blessed with having the opportunity to be stewards of an incredible open space system where people can escape the challenges of urban life every day by going to some place where they can renew their bodies and renew their spirits. With the increase in costs of living, $4 a gallon, the specter of $4 a gallon gasoline, people are going to stay at home and stay in this metropolitan area this summer and use the Metropolitan Regional Park System more than they have in the past. When you take increased visits, couple that with increased operational costs, the commodities that we use are the same that other people use. Costs are increasing for our costs. So we're facing a situation in which the cost of doing business is increasing, and the funding sources are decreasing in order to accomplish what needs to be accomplished. It seems to be a path towards disaster. Deferred maintenance is always a short-term solution to a problem. I grew up with a value system that was imposed on me, that taught to me. It wasn't imposed, it was taught, but I have adopted, that you learn to take care of what you have, and you take care of it very well, because you are only short-term stewards of that for a brief period of time, and then it moves on to someone else. Deferred maintenance flies in the face of that kind of value system in which you're taking care of what you have, and that's what we're facing here. Now, while the dollar amounts may seem to be minor, they will have an impact upon the visitors to the Minneapolis Park and Rec system, as it will to each of the members that are part of the regional park system. And what we will see will be fewer facilities that will be available. The facilities will have a shoddier look, and ultimately the cost of bringing it back to a level will be higher than it would be if maintenance had simply kept up to the standards that it should be at. With that, Madam Chair, I'm happy to answer questions.
All right, thank you, Mr. Schmidt. One thing that we might want to know, if we are able to, in our budget deliberations, is what will be happening in the bonding bill. And I don't know if we'll have the luxury of having that decision made before we do our budget. Probably not. They'll probably be on the same parallel track. But obviously, there would be some proposal in the bonding bill that could help with maintenance or for Metro Parks, or would that just be for acquisition? Do you know? I can't remember.
Madam Chair, there are parts of the proposed bonding bill that have some improvements to the regional park system. Those are always beneficial and do help reduce the maintenance costs, but the O&M funds are really used for day-to-day operations and maintenance of the system. They're not used for significant rehab or bonding-type proposals. They actually help to defer the need for rehab or long-term bonding by keeping things functional and maintained and in good condition.
And we heard we had a good presentation from Senator Torres Ray about the problems along Minnehaha Creek and the crumbling walls and pathways there. And are those things that you could work on with O&M dollars, or do you need bonding dollars or capital dollars to do all of those?
There are portions. The bonding dollars are needed in order to accomplish the overhaul of the system that was built during the WPA era and has deteriorated to a point where operations dollars cannot fix it any longer or keep it maintained. So those bonding dollars are needed to do that rehab work. The maintenance dollars then keep it so that we can enjoy another 30, 40, 50, 60 years life from it once it has been rehabbed.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am not sure that this will be a question for our presenter right now, but perhaps for the previous person. I'm just curious about the share of the cuts for Minneapolis and Three Rivers Park District. They seem to be really huge compared to others, and I wonder if it is a proportion based on kind of the actual amount, and 1.88 is applied to all equally or not. I would like to understand that, because you have these two have a kind of disproportionate share of the cuts, and I would like to ask you that question.
Mr. Stefferud?
Madam Chair and Senator Torres Ray, these cuts are proportional. The amount that you see there is applied proportionally to all the agencies. Three Rivers Park District and Minneapolis Park Board get roughly 25% each of the appropriation. So the cut roughly is 25% for them.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you both very much. Next, Ron Harnack. Okay. Oh, and Ray Bone. All right. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Ron Harnack, representing the Red River Watershed Management Board. We appreciate the opportunity to speak a little bit to the governor's recommended reductions. In two particular areas, one is with the Board of Water and Soil Resources and the reduction of $150,000 per year to the drainage work team and the technical assistance support that that provides. Drainage systems around the state are becoming more and more significant in addressing the water quality issues that the state faces. There are thousands of miles of drainage systems in the state, and with each passing year, we see increasing number of impaired waters being designated. The drainage work team and the support technical staff that was funded last year provides a great opportunity for collaboration and coordination amongst the drainage authorities, provides some unique technical support to work with the drainage authorities to put BMPs on the ground that are going to be more effective in addressing these water quality issues for the future. The reduction in this funding, I believe, will significantly hinder that technical capability and result in not as effective drainage system maintenance, repair, and improvements in the future that will more effectively address the water quality and flood issues that those systems are realizing. Your support in keeping that funding is greatly appreciated, and we would look forward to working with you in trying to maintain the integrity of that has been established last year. The second element is the Red River mediation. The governor's, and that is within DNR, Division of Waters. The governor's recommendation reduces the mediation funding by $30,000 in 09 and by $60,000 thereafter. The mediation dollars has provided, been very pivotal in providing a coordinated forum and process to more effectively and aggressively move flood damage reduction projects forward. It's provided a balance of flood damage reduction and natural resource enhancement, and it has resulted in significant reduction in litigation and conflict between various interests in moving forward. The project work teams have state agencies, federal agencies, environmental interests, landowners sitting at the table working together to prioritize how we can effectively reduce flooding and enhance natural resources in the Red River Basin. This funding provides part of the state's commitment to participation in that process. Flooding remains a very significant issue in the Red River Valley, and we do not believe it is timely to reduce the effort of the state's commitment and obligation to assist in reducing those flood damage efforts in the Red River Valley. So we appreciate the committee's consideration of retaining the funding for the Red River mediation program. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Harnack. Are there questions? Okay, Mr. Bone.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ray Bone. I'm here representing the Minnesota Association of Watershed Districts, and I want to just say me too as it relates to what Mr. Harnack just said. The drainage work group is actually an idea that was floated several years ago, and it actually became an outgrowth of the drainage work group that we have underway right now and has been underway for the last few years. And frankly, long term, I think it was probably the best thing that came out of that work group, although we did many other important things with the buffers and that sort of thing. You know, we're moving into a whole new arena with the impaired waters, TMDLs, and we just, as drainage authorities, I believe we need to look at new ways of doing things, and we're going to be forced to with the Clean Water Act and the TMDLs that we're going to be working on. And I think this technical help is really essential for us in terms of being able to start looking at alternatives and other ways to do things. So we believe it's a critical element for us to being able to address some of the impaired waters issues that we're going to be looking at down the road as drainage authorities. So we would ask that you take a really good hard look at that issue in particular when you're looking at budget cuts.
All right. I guess I should ask both of you. I should have asked all the other witnesses too. Except you're not part of the governor's team. What do you have any recommendations for where we could find budget savings? Any volunteers or suggestions?
Madam Chair, your pay grade's higher than mine, so I'll leave that up to you.
Only one thought for consideration, Madam Chair, is if you look at Bowser's budget in particular, they already did decide to take money from some of the other two programs and put it towards some other activities, still leaving a significant balance in kind of new programs that were established last year. That might be some consideration.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Is there anyone else who'd like to speak on the budget? All right. is Senator Dibble on his way?
He's presenting.
Oh, okay. We don't have an author yet. I see Mr. Strom is here. I guess Senator Dibble's presenting a bill in another committee. So, members, let me just take a moment to ask all of you the same question. If members have suggestions for how we can reduce budget items, we need those now. And over the next week to 10 days, we'll be putting together our recommendations as a division along with Senator Cohen. And as you know, if things like K-12 education are off the table, which I don't know if that's true or not, but there's certainly been some discussion about that in the public arena. Our division will be looked at as a source of trying to find savings with this budget deficit that we have. It's really a lot of money. Senator Vickerman.
Well, Madam Chair, I believe veterans is off the table, too, unless I didn't.
Was that your decision, Senator Vickerman? Or?
You bet it's my
decision. Well, I have some ideas for what I'd like to have off the table as well, and I guess I would. There are some things that we do need to protect, no matter what, if we possibly can. I would welcome all of your ideas about that. And we're meeting tonight. Finance Division chairs are meeting with Senator Cohen tonight to start working on some general ideas about the budget, and I'll be working with all of you members over the next week to get into some more detail. Senator Torres-Ray.
Madam Chair, I would like to suggest that we, I know that it is going to be difficult because of the time constraints that we have, but as I review some of these policies and I understand more the work that the different organizations do, I would like to suggest that we take an in-depth review of the different administrative functions of the different departments that control this funding and really figure out how we could establish structures that are more efficient and effective in terms of doing the work. I've been trying to connect with several constituents of mine who work in different departments, and they do have some suggestions, and I know that, you know, time is pressing, so this is kind of a more long-term process, but I do think that that we need to take a look at. I haven't had a chance to really review kind of the cost of implementation of the different programs and administrative costs. And I don't know. I know in healthcare, we have these constant reviews of how much money of the budget is allocated for administrative purposes. But I haven't had a chance to look at this particular budget, and I don't know if you can give us an idea of what, in your view, is that a possibility? Have you heard of a possible, perhaps, ideas that we could pursue in that direction?
Well, I think we're always welcome good suggestions. Senator Saxon, did you hear?
Well, Madam Chair, I've watched this in a couple of committees now, that recommendations, particularly coming from the governor, call for removing positions and doing it on attrition. It's not going to hurt anything, but these people are obviously valuable and provide services. So we're just eliminating services, basically. So I think that and I understand because of, you know, the forest issues and you and the clean water issues, that we did pretty well last year, and I just want us to be aware of removing positions is removing services too, and we've got to be careful with it.
Yeah, that's an important issue for us to be looking at. And, you know, I think we're also, in some of our agencies, I think the DNR in particular, we're looking at a wave of retirements that will take, you know, I can't remember the number, I've heard 40% or some large percent of the agency will be leaving in the next few years in a very short time. And so as we're losing the most experienced staff, how does that affect services and the ability to do their job and deliver good value to the taxpayers and to the public is a really big question as well. How do we know that we're not kind of, you know, getting rid of all the experienced folks, and we're going to be left with not enough of a team to really be able to manage into the future? Senator Saxon?
So, Madam Chair, addressing what Senator Torres Reyes said, I mean, it's good for our administration to be lean and mean, but doing it by eliminating people is not necessarily the way to do it. So.
But I think, Senator Torres Reyes, I think you raise a good point. We need to always be looking for new and better ways to do things. And if there's ways to be efficient that doesn't harm the delivery of good service to the public, I'm all for that investigation. So I think we ought to be looking at that carefully. Senator Chaudhry?
I'll just add, Madam Chair, that whatever cuts that we consider, we consider them very carefully, because if we make a cut this year, it is entirely likely that cut will be permanent, because this is an area of our budget that is last in and first out. And as you can see, the priorities of education, healthcare, veterans, the burden then falls on lower budget areas, lower priority areas like the environment. And maybe we all need to share the pain, and that's fine. But in good times, we don't get to share the wealth either. And so that's the problem. We need to take particular care what we're cutting, because it is going to be a long struggle to replace that money in the future.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, given that we face a structural deficit that's only going to be worse in the next biennium, and that most of the new money we were able to get in this committee last year was one-time money. So it's not going to be around for the long haul. So you're absolutely right. Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I guess to participate in the discussion here, is the majority going to offer some structure for this dealing with the deficit at some point? I mean, we've got the governor's proposal, and I think all of us have questions about some of the things that have been proposed, but have the committees and the come up with an alternative? Is that something that you're working on, or when would that be coming forward for discussion?
Well, Senator Hahn, Senator Cohen has asked division chairs over the last month, since before session started, to come up with ideas. You know, so we've had some conversations about ideas, but none of it is official yet. We wanted to wait and see what the governor's budget was and really delve into that, and we've now concluded our hearings on the governor's budget recommendations, so I think we have a pretty good idea of what those look like. And as I mentioned, Senator Cohen's meeting with division chairs tonight to take our first stab at talking through what that will look like. But also keep in mind, a week from Friday is the deadline for the budget to pass, essentially, out of Senator Cohen's full committee. So I can't tell you. I know what it's going to look like yet. I don't know. I'm working with Senator Cohen, and he's in charge of the overall process, and we are following his lead. But I will certainly be working with committee members over the next week to 10 days to try to hash out our own proposal, which will be an alternative to the governor's budget recommendations. We may adopt some of the governor's proposals, but I can tell you for a fact we're not going to adopt a lot of them.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Hamm.
Thank you. And is the proposals as they pertain to this division, would they be coming back here then for hearing sometime before the completion of the?
Absolutely. We'll definitely have a hearing in this committee, in the division on the budget for this division. Absolutely. So that'll be sometime next week. So we will have a very active schedule next week for this division.
Thank you.
So keep that in mind. Well, I think we don't have authors. This is a little frustrating. I know it's a busy time, but we only have two bills on the agenda. I heard Senator Rosen was coming. Like, is she in the building? She's on her way. Who does she have for authors? All right, Mr. Bull, and can you come up and start explaining the bill, please? And I guess since Senator Dibble is presenting another bill, we'll take Senator Rosen's first.
Chair, I'm Mike Bull from the Office of Energy Security.
And I'm sorry, I have to remind you also, you've got to have the microphones really close in this room.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Oh, sorry, Mr. Bull, I'm going to let Senator Dibble. He hadn't even gotten his first sentence out, so.
Telling jokes? Was he tap dancing?
We were discussing our microphones, more or less. So we have a real-life senator, Senator Dibble. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. We have Senate File 3096.
Senator Rosen, Senator Dibble beat you by 25 seconds.
Okay. Madam Chair, I have the A4 and the A5 amendments. And I think the Council said the A5 could be incorporated into the A4.
This bill has been to other committees, correct?
So. That's correct, yeah. So this is not an author's amendment, per se. So I can speak to it first, perhaps, and then.
Okay, you said the A5, you'd like to combine them, basically, and offer them as one amendment? Is that what you said?
Mr. Knopf said I could do that.
Okay, because, well, they're standalone sections, so. But,
okay.
Well, let's hear from Mr. Knopf.
Well, Madam Chair, I was told that the contents of the A5, what the author was thought might be in the A4 amendment, it's not in there. So what I told him he could do is just, if he wants to move the A4 as a delete everything amendment, he can just incorporate A5 into A4 and move the whole thing as a delete everything amendment.
Okay, that's fine. But it is a delete all amendment, so we'll have to go through the whole thing.
Okay.
Go ahead, Senator Dibble.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. What we propose to do in this bill is to allow both the state to do energy efficiency improvements to their buildings, and I'll have Mr. DeFeber talk a little bit more about the state part, because the primary focus of the bill really has to do with local units of government doing energy efficiency improvements to their buildings, to their structures. And it would do that primarily through allowing the local units of government to access financing in the form of lease purchase financing, which is a form of financing similar to the way a lot of school districts, for example, purchase fleets of buses. They do this through a lease purchase financing mechanism through the private sector. And it's not bonding and it's not debt. The repayment, the annual repayment, is done through an annual appropriation. It's collateralized, of course, by the equipment that's being purchased over time through this financing mechanism. It would ask that the entity that's taking advantage of this financing work with the state agency. To find a high-quality consultant, work with the B3 database that we have, where all of the buildings and many of the public buildings in the state are entered into a database with all kinds of information about their energy specifications, their energy use, and the like, and come up with a program where they can identify the most cost-effective and timely sorts of improvements, some of the low-hanging fruit, for example, you know, conditioning windows, HVAC systems, some of the envelope, building envelope changes that they can make. And they would have available to them through this financing also an assurance that the savings that they would realize from the energy improvements would be greater than what they would have paid otherwise in their utility bills annually. So that allows for the cash flow that allows for the repayment of the financing, which would take anywhere from 5 to 10 years. Have I missed any high points? I think those are the high points of the bill. If in fact the savings were not realized, the cash flow wasn't positive, the state would be in a position to, in effect, refinance, allow some cash to be made available for the purpose of lengthening the term of the financing so that those payments could be, annual payments could be brought down to, again, realize that positive cash flow. The consulting, the technical work that's done to figure out exactly what improvements are going to be made would also be a part of that financing. That would also come be included or wrapped into that financing package. Mr. DeFeber here from the Department of Commerce, who can help fill out my details.
All right. Thank you, Senator Dibble. Mr. DeFeber, do you want to testify?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jeremy DeFeber. I'm with the Office of Energy Security in the Department of Commerce. And just very briefly, of course, answer any questions that the committee members may have. The program establishes two prongs. One is for state buildings, and that authorizes transfer of funds to the Department of Administration to provide high-quality technical services to state building owners and operators to develop packages of energy efficiency measures and, to the extent feasible, renewable measures that will provide a cash flow that is meeting the needs of those institutions. Largely, we're trying to look at positive cash flows where we can. Also authorizes the entering into a master lease agreement to provide lease purchase financing to those entities at most flexible and best terms available, and that would be financing through private sector. It's an instrument that has become fairly common in financing public sector improvements. The other part of the program that Senator Dibble spoke more directly to in local governments is designed to address what we find as the main barriers to making energy improvements in local government buildings. That's access to high-quality technical information. The people that operate those buildings have expertise in areas that are their mission and are not always comfortable in making decisions about energy-saving improvements. That is the first barrier. Second barrier is access to financing. And again, we look at tax-exempt lease template financing. In this case, not a master lease, but a template offering, so that the same best terms are available to any local government that's participating in the program, whether it's Minneapolis or Minnesota. The size of the local government would not make any difference as far as the terms that were being offered by the private sector to them. The third barrier is largely a perception of risk and how to assess that risk, particularly that somewhat is predicated on the fact that the local governments do not have in-house the technical expertise to really do their internal assessment of proposed measures. Our mechanism is not necessarily a guarantee of energy savings because we don't really have the resources available to do that. Ours is a method of augmenting cash flow so that we try to keep them in a positive cash flow situation, but we do recover funds that we loan to them over time when they're done financing their improvement.
Okay. Mr. DeFeber, could you just kind of walk us through, if you were in charge of a building, what would be the steps that you would take, or Senator Dibble, to go through the process here?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think,
what would be the first thing you'd do?
The first thing I would do is probably we will do some targeting and sorting of priority potential borrowers or improvement projects, using B3 data to find those buildings that are performing at a level lower than the state average, to try and concentrate on what then may be, as Senator Dibble has said, low-hanging fruit. I think we will probably use local contractors and local engineering and architectural firms, energy auditors, to provide on-site in-depth analysis in order to actually work up packages of measures. What we would try to do through this program is package the best combination of measures with the financing terms available to try and ensure with reasonable reliability that the borrower is going to, or the local government is going to have a positive cash flow through the term of their financing, because that is often an issue. Is if a decision needs to be made at a school district about something that is core mission education related versus a building improvement, it's natural that they say we need to pay attention to our knitting first, and often building improvements end up at the bottom of the list.
So, Senator Dibble,
I just wanted to add maybe ask your question first, and then I want to add a little piece, because there's a point at which they take advantage of utility SIP programs here at this spot.
Well, so the first thing is, so you're saying that Commerce is going to identify the buildings. That's the first step. You're not waiting for people to come to you. You're going to look at this list, this audit of state and local buildings, and come up with the best candidates to use this program and approach them.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe it'll be a combination of that, but we would do the positive outreach where we're looking at the best candidates through B3, certainly. But I don't think that would preclude potential candidates from approaching us either.
Okay.
And Madam Chair, I just want to say,
and
at this point, as the financing package is being pulled together, it's also important, and the bill requires that the local units of government are speaking with their utility to see what sorts of resources are available through the Conservation Improvement Program, you know, as we now have it envisioned through last year's Demand Efficiency Act, so that utility effort is being taken advantage of. And this is certainly something the utilities want to be doing and want to be included in, and we make sure that if they are a part of the financing package, the financing mix, I shouldn't say financing per se, but they're providing resources to take care of some of the work that's identified that needs to be done. They can count that towards the energy savings goal that we set out for them in last year's bill.
Mm-hmm. So how would a local government or a school district make the payments for this, for these improvements, would come out of their operating funds? Is that right, generally?
Yes.
Even if it's paying for, you know, major capital improvements?
Yes. But they'll be paying less than they would otherwise be paying for their energy bill annually. So they're saving money.
And so, they're like for a school district, I mean, they have different mechanisms for raising capital dollars than they do for raising for operating dollars. But this would come out of their operating budget, but they'd get the... They'd be able to buy some, you know, HVAC or other major capital improvements using their operating dollars that they're now spending on energy costs. Correct? Is that more?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Essentially, as the lease purchase agreement ends up as on the operating side of the budget, they would get essentially long-term financing under the agreement, and then the repayments for that are an operating expenditure, and the structure then is intended to have those payments on the operating budget be less than the savings to the operating budget on utility costs.
So is there interest as part of that calculation? They're paying interest, right, because this is privately financed?
Yes, Madam Chair. The typical rates are on tax-exempt leases right now are pretty close to general obligation bonding costs.
4%? Okay. All right. Any questions? Senator Hamm?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. DeFebre, I wanted to just talk to you a little bit or ask you some clarification about Subdivision 7, which is the Supplemental Cash Flow Agreement. And I'm reading through this and trying to understand what this does, but it seems to me what this is doing is essentially saying that there will be money saved by the program, and if there isn't any money saved, then there will be this supplementary funding coming from the state that will, in effect, be the money, the cost reduction, that if there is no money saved in the energy project itself, that there will be saving in the form of this supplemental cash that would be given to the local unit of government. Is that a correct reading of that?
All right. Who wants to answer? Mr. DeFebre?
Oh, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator. It is largely a correct reading, except that it the savings will ultimately not be in the form of the payment under the supplemental agreement, because that eventually does have to be paid back. And what the supplemental agreement will do is allow the annual cost of financing to be reduced so that it is brought into line with what the actual realized savings are.
And Madam Chair.
So it's just going to cover the interest or the financing costs?
Well,
that's what this additional public money would go for?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It would essentially be a loan of funds for the term of the financing agreement plus however many years after that is necessary to repay those funds while maintaining a positive cash flow.
Senator Dibble.
So, Madam Chair, the supplemental cash flow agreement would only be used, money would only be used in that instance when the savings weren't as great as had been anticipated. And so the purpose of the supplemental cash flow agreement would be to extend the term of the financing, to amortize it differently so that that annual payment is brought down.
So until it was paid off?
Correct.
Senator Hahn.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. DeFebre, I guess in reading this, I don't see the language that describes what you've described. It doesn't, in this portion of the bill, talk about that there be any end to this. In fact, it would suggest that it could go on indefinitely, since it would cover obligations of the local government to operate and maintain the energy improvement, which could have a life much longer than the amount of time it was financed. But it seems to me this is an agreement to say that as long as this thing has been put in place by a local government, their supplemental funds would be in place to make sure that if it didn't achieve any energy savings or cost savings, that there would be a supplemental amount that would come in and affect reduce costs through the supplemental funding process. And I've got some concern about that, because it doesn't limit this to any time or doesn't say that it can only be done to repay the financing of the original investment. It says it can be used for local government to operate and maintain, which I would take it to be indefinitely. And it also talks about having procedures in the agreement to modify the agreement if the project adversely affects cost savings. So the way I'm reading this is that it's a permanent financing structure to allow for these to get put in place, but if they start operating and don't achieve the cost savings, that this supplemental money would be permanently available to make sure the local unit of government saw some reduction in the costs that they had before. Is that not correct, or am I misreading that?
Mr. DeFebre.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe the key point would be in lines 623 through 625, in that we are lending funds to the local government, which I think is predicated on a necessity to pay back. Plus, it is so that cumulative payments made under their financing agreement minus the commissioner's loan and does not exceed the annual savings. So there ends up being a calculation of at that point where continued savings exceed the financing costs they would have to pay back.
So you wouldn't forgive anyone's loan or interfere with that financing agreement between the private lender and the whatever the government entity is. It would just fill the gap to
right.
extend that longer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, we are not touching the agreement, the tax-exempt lease agreement at all. That is not modified at all. This would be a supplemental agreement that acts alongside of it in order to help them manage cash flow.
So they'd still owe the basic amount to the bank?
Yes, and that was an important facet because in order to be able to market those leases, you would not want them to be subject to those sorts of modifications.
So what is the limit to what, how much, I mean, what's in the sort of the worst case scenario? I think Senator Hahn is trying to come up with the worst case scenario here. What would be the worst case scenario for extending this out? I mean, is there any limit to how long it could be refinanced for? Say, you know, there was a bum vendor who had really bad equipment that didn't work. You know, what would be the worst thing that could happen? That taxpayers would be on the hook for, or
I think the
funding sources.
Thank you, ma'am. The language does limit the total exposure to that which is available under the appropriation.
Sure.
So that would have to be, you know, considered the absolute worst case. So it's not an open obligation. It's not a moral obligation. And I believe we would likely be writing limited supplemental agreements to cover a set cap amount, simply as it is a limited resource, the funds that are available, and in order to get a significant amount of work done, I think we may not be able to manage all of the perceived risk. We may not be able to say we can cover 100%, but if we can structure packages that, number one, have a reasonable coverage ratio. If we say we anticipate that something that's going to cost you a dollar will actually, over time, will actually save you $1.20, and we only guarantee a dollar, we've got a little bit of room to begin with. And we anticipate doing that kind of probably a 20% or that range coverage. That plus a limit on the guarantee based on the fact that the language does say we only have recourse to that appropriation.
All right. Senator Hahn.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I'm just trying to understand the terms of this agreement, which I still am not clear that there is any limit to it. You do talk about lending, so it is a lending instrument, but it doesn't make it clear there's any limit to that lending, nor that the funds ever be repaid. It says that the payments would be made in a structure so that it would sort of subtract or can't exceed the actual energy and operating cost savings. Well, if there are no energy and cost savings, then the amount of money would be there permanently. And it says it's repayable only to the extent that there's a positive budget impact, which could, again, you might never have it under the operation of the facility itself. So I guess the limit would be just the amount of the appropriation that would be made. And the concern I have about this is it seems to me that if we, whatever we allocate or appropriate for this program, that becomes, in effect, a direct subsidy of these programs that may or may not have any real efficiency or energy benefit at all. But because of the supplemental agreement, they would appear to be, because they would show to the local unit of government a savings as a result of the supplemental funds. And I'm very troubled by that because I don't think it makes it clear, I guess, long-term going forward, that these are good investments. And so I guess I would argue that this should be redone to do something that would be more tied directly to the investment and have a definite term and a definite payback and with interest so that the project itself could be amortized properly the way it would be otherwise. But this, to me, is not a typical loan agreement.
Mr. DeFebra.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator. I think part of the program in delivering technical services to develop packages of measures in buildings that are going to provide the cash flow that we're looking at is a key to it. Obviously, if we were willy-nilly going out and saying we're going to take any improvement you might suggest under any circumstances and we'll provide the supplemental agreement, that would be far more significant risk. But what we're proposing here is to create guidelines for those technical services to review the engineering analyses of those, to train the people that are doing those engineering analyses, and to ultimately say this is a package of measures under these financing conditions that we believe provides a reasonable likelihood of success with that coverage ratio built into it. So obviously there was always a little, some sort of risk involved in any kind of building improvement. But I think we're trying to manage that risk in a reasonable way.
And Madam Chair.
Senator Hand, and then I think we need to move on.
And Mr. Lefebvre, I understand that the intention is to try to outline and define projects that are likely to be successful, and I appreciate that. But there is no discipline in this agreement that would require that they actually be successful. And I think that's the problem, is that it doesn't say if you put in place an idea that everybody thought was going to be a great idea, turns out not to be, all we have is a commitment to keep funding it in a way so the local unit government can see some savings to their local budget at the cost of the state budget. And I think that those things are not good structures because it sends the wrong message to people to think they've got something that is working when it really isn't. And so I guess I would suggest that we redo this to make it a little more straightforward kind of a financing arrangement that would have some risk to it so that if it fails, it can be terminated. There's nothing in here that says if the project fails and doesn't deliver that it gets shut down. It just continues to be financed, and I think that's the problem.
Senator Dibble.
Madam Chair, while it's we can certainly put a term, end term date, I'm comfortable with that. But it's certainly standard. Two points. One is, the financing is available, in consultation with the Department of Commerce, who is working with technical consultants, and so we're assured that there will be a high quality of technical review. And if things don't work out, if the savings isn't as great as anticipated. The standard practice when you have these energy audits is to go in and find out what's going on. Are the folks not operating the building the way they should be? Are they leaving windows open all over the place? Or, folks aren't trained in to operate the equipment? Did we just not know something? And is there a plan for remediation? Did we not nail down something? Right. So that's that would be very, very standard practice. When these sorts of energy improvements are financed. So as a practical matter, I don't think the worst-case scenario that Senator Hand envisions would come to pass. But if we need to nail down some technical language to put, a time certain by which, or a certain amount of time under which these financing terms can be limited, I'm comfortable with that.
I think that's appropriate to have some kind of a upper end, but I think the point of the bill is, utilities invest millions of dollars every year in Minnesota based on their experience with saving money at these investments. Most of them do work. Do either of you have information about the amount that the state has already saved from the increased energy efficiency requirements that have been put into law in the last 2 years? I heard that number. An architect testified about that in our energy committee. Oh, come on. One of you guys must know that. Office of Energy Security, can you tell us? it's in the millions of dollars that the state has already saved in operating dollars based on implementing are 30% better than building code requirement for state bonded dollars. It's in, I remember, 40 some million dollars, and I could be completely wrong, so that's why I'm wondering if I'd like to have that written down. But there must be somebody in state government who has that answer, so we'll work on getting that if you guys don't have that.
I will search for it.
Thank you. I know Rick Carter is the one who testified to it because he's heads that working group on the B3 standards, and so he testified to that in our energy committee, the policy committee. So who is going to make the decision about whether this investment is a good energy efficiency investment? Is that something that the lender will be deciding? commerce, the utility, or just the local government will make that decision? Who's sort of overseeing that? What's the accountability there?
The Department of Commerce, or the commissioner, Madam Chair, would kind of be the one kind of, you know, receives all the information, you know, and green lights a particular, particular project to move forward.
Okay. And so maybe you could just give us briefly how you, you know, based on the experience that you already have doing this, Mr. DeFebra, or the department, on just give us comfort that these loans will save money for these government entities.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think beyond just expertise at the department, we would be looking at working with a primary subcontractor to particularly develop technical standards and to work with the technical services community in order to deliver energy assessments. We have worked in institutional buildings going back to the late 70s through what had been the Federal Schools and Hospitals Program, the state's Energy Investment Loan Program, which began for public schools in 1983, was one of our programs. And we had systems where we provided for tiered assessments of energy-saving potential within those buildings from essentially a self-administered walkthrough through a moderate-level assessment of a building to a very detailed technical analysis of a building's components and energy-using systems and what potential savings might be there and the economic analysis of what those might have. Ultimately, the value of that sort of thing is predicated on how well we work with, I think, the engineering and architectural community and the energy auditing community on developing standards and delivering those sorts of technical analyses.
Senator Dibble, so the money that's in this bill, you're asking for money from the oil overcharge account. It would be for that backup. That's all the public money that's here.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Is that correct?
Yes.
So the mm-hmm. basic funding mechanism here is a public-private partnership without public dollars. That's just sort of the backup in case of problems.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay,
that is
thank
correct.
You. That's helpful. Mr. DeFebra.
I think that we are looking at probably front-ending some of the technical service costs and then recovering them through the lease purchase agreement. So there may be some expenditure and recovery of some of the underlying Exxon funds.
So how much of the – we don't really have that. How much money would that take out of this?
Madam Chair, in the appropriation, $1 million is set aside to go to the Department of Administration for their technical services program. The remainder, which right now is about $7 million, would remain in that fund. I would think that over time, I would hope to have conserved at least $6 million of that fund over, you know, over 4 years, let's say. There's potential risk to the fund, so I can't say definitively that that's not going to happen. But we are looking at largely a model of recovering all of our costs.
And what is the Department of Administration's role? What technical support would they provide?
Madam Chair, the Department of Administration would provide technical support and arranging of financing packages for state buildings.
Okay. Okay, but they wouldn't be applying the standards about cost effectiveness of energy savings, would they?
Yes. Madam Chair, yes, they would. They would.
Rather than commerce?
Right. No, I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question. They would be required to have the same cost effectiveness.
But they don't have that technical expertise about energy savings programs. They don't really know anything about that, I don't think, or maybe they do, but I doubt it.
No. Madam Chair, they'd be serving in an administrative role, you know, helping handle. Department of Commerce would still be responsible for carrying out the technical work, the improvements to the buildings, the commissioning afterwards, all of that.
Does it say that in here somewhere?
In the first part of the bill, you want to point out.
All right. Is there, thank you. Does Mr. Strom or Mr. Johnson wish to testify?
Madam Chair,
Senator Hahn?
Before Mr. Lefebvre leaves, I'd like to go back to the supplemental cash flow agreement and just clarify again the lending, the amount of money, or the money that is lent, what is the rate that is going to be charged to the recipients, what is the interest rate, and you've got an appropriation to fund this supplemental agreements of $1 million. In the best case scenario, that would eventually grow over time, I would imagine, as you get the loans repaid and there'd be interest paid on those loans. And I'm just wondering what the expectation is of this. Is this going to take 1 year, 10 years, and what is the interest rate that you're going to charge on the lending that is done?
Mr. DeFebvre.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator, I believe we have, can't find the language immediately, but I thought we had specified that we would charge no more than what the interest on the underlying lease purchase agreement for that project is.
On page 7.
7.6.
So,
Madam Chair.
I think, let me just be clear on this, Senator Dibble. Is your assumption that we won't need any of that money? Or that we're likely to spend some of that money?
Yeah. Yes, Madam Chair, other than the little bit that will be needed, but that will come back into the fund for the state buildings. but yes, my assumption is that oil overcharge money would not be needed. That's correct.
Because there's plenty of energy efficient, of cost-effective loans that can be made for building improvements.
Privately. Yes.
Using private financing that could be paid off for less than the cost of your current energy usage. I mean, I think that's sort of a basic assumption that we need to understand. And
Madam Chair, in combination with utility incentives and programs and the like available through the conservation improvement programs.
Okay, great. Thank you. Mr. Johnson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Craig Johnson. I represent the League of Minnesota Cities. We do support this bill. It provides a voluntary tool for communities to use. And as I'm sure you're aware, after the amount of time you've spent discussing energy efficiency, energy conservation, energy costs, this is a priority for our folks out at the local level. One, there are extremely expensive buildings out there that we know we could be doing a better job with if we could overcome the hurdles to do that. But secondly, there's a tremendous expectation that local governments be playing a lead role in stepping up to find these kind of improvements and making them. And so there's been a lot of interest in this, and in fact it was one of the major topics at the last annual conference of the League of Minnesota Cities. To be clear, a lot of cities have started doing these kinds of things already. They have. If you are a city that has environmental service building providers, you may well have worked through those on some of these kinds of contracts. This does not prohibit that; allows that to continue. There's no requirement that cities suddenly stop using their current vendor and start using this program. But this provides an additional tool and some assistance from the state to get through the hurdles. And really, the hurdles, as you heard earlier, but I can summarize very briefly, our technical expertise, because many of our cities just do not know which of these energy improvements will cash flow the best over a certain period of time. Financing, so the arrangement of private financing, not state financing, but a larger pool of financing where cities can get the benefit of being part of that larger pool. And then finally, the risk, where the investment is shown that it's going to end up paying off. The risk is paying off of the risk is not unique to this program. The vendors that we work with normally set their contracts up the same way. They set up the contract so that over X number of years, the project ends up paying for itself through the energy savings being paid as the lease cost for the equipment upgrade. This would function very similarly, except instead of a private business putting that money into up front to cover risk and then writing a check at the end if the risk doesn't come up. This is the state having a pot of money where if the risk ends up being miscalculated, the project gets refinanced for a slightly longer period of time to cover that risk. To the question that came up earlier, Madam Chair, about a time period for that risk, we are very used to working with a 15-year timeline, and in fact, if you look at the first section of the bill relating to state government on line 2.19 and 2.20, For state contracts, it limits the duration of the contract to 15 years. That language could be brought over, Madam Chair, to the second section of the bill or similar language on to page 6 probably somewhere and insert it as a time limit in subdivision 6 where it talks about standard financing agreements. We could put a time limit on there for the duration of that pretty easily. And my folks actually are very comfortable with that. We prefer time limits on these contracts to make sure, as Senator Hahn mentioned earlier, we don't end up in a contract that never ends. Because that obviously is not good for local government in the long run. I would just wrap up that this is a very useful program. We are very pleased that it's been brought forward and that the administration is working on it, and we do hope it can move forward to provide a tool for cities that may not have other options readily available to do these kinds of improvements. Thank you, Madam Chair. Happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Do you have any idea what the potential is for energy savings in locally owned buildings around the state?
Madam Chair, members, I don't have specific dollar figures that I've received. We have literally just in cities, we have hundreds of buildings that would likely qualify for this program once the analysis of the buildings is completed, the B3 type of benchmarking. If you add in other local units of government buildings, schools and counties in particular, we end up with thousands of buildings around the state that are likely to have work that needs to be done to maximize energy. And as energy costs go up, it just becomes more and more important for us at the local level to find those opportunities.
Okay, great. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you. Did Mr. Strom want to say anything? Okay. Are there any other questions from the committee? Oh, you want to testify? Uh-oh, admin is here. Uh-oh, sorry.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Wayne Wislaska. I'm with the Department of Administration, Real Estate and Construction Services. And just want to your point, Madam Chair, we administer this program as part of our overall energy management program and also our oversight of construction projects. So it would be a very useful tool at the state level as well for the same reasons that the city's mentioned and others have mentioned. It gives us the necessary ability to get the necessary technical assistance. It also gives us access to financing to do these projects.
And I, my comments about admin and technical expertise was focused on the idea of determining what are cost-effective energy improvements, and is that something that you all do, or do you use other sources of technical help for that?
Madam Chair, we do have architectural and engineering staff, so we would utilize them, but we'd also, for more detailed energy audits, we would hire consulting firms to do that that work.
Okay, but this bill will rely mostly on the B3 audit that's underway already?
Madam Chair, exactly as described, that would be the first place you'd look. You'd use that tool to identify the low-hanging fruit that's been described. What's the buildings that you can have the greatest return on investment?
So can you see state agencies using private financing then, getting a private bank loan to do this type of energy improvement?
Madam Chair, absolutely.
Okay, great. All right, thank you very much. Are there questions for Department of Administration? All right. Senator Torres Ray, would you like to move the amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you. I would like to move Senate File 3096.
Well, Madam Senator Torres Ray, we're just doing amended. The amendment. The just A4 the amendment. And A5 amendments incorporated into one A4 delete all amendment.
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Dibble.
Madam Chair, Mr. Knopf had an idea in response to Senator Hahn's concern.
Okay.
Can we incorporate that now, or do you want
sure.
to wait?
Well, let's adopt these amendments, and then we can listen if there's other language you want to suggest.
Do it now and incorporate the whole thing.
Well, that's fine. If it all fits, why not? Mr. Knopf, go ahead.
Madam Chair, it'd be on line 6.32. This is where, if you'll see, the previous sentence says that terms and conditions of the supplemental cash flow agreement must be agreed to. And then, but after the period on 6.32, insert a supplemental cash flow agreement shall not exceed 15 years from the date of final completion of the qualifying energy improvement project. So it would be consistent with what's in Section 1 of the bill.
Okay. Senator Dibble, you support that language?
Yes, Madam Chair.
And Senator Torres-Ray, would you incorporate that into your motion for the amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair and...
Senator Kubley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess we're incorporating the A5 amendment in the A4 one also. Is that correct?
Yes. Thank Along you. With Mr. Knopf's oral
amendment. Thank you.
Suggestion. Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I wanted to offer an amendment to the amendment before we adopted it. Frankly, I was thinking that given the testimony that the idea was not to have to spend this money in the first place, I thought we should delete section or subdivision 7 in lines 6.17 to 6.19 in the last half of 6.16 after the comma to just delete this whole supplemental cash flow agreement and let this project stand on its own. And make sure that if it's a good project, that it's going to be financed a straightforward way and it would stand and fall on its merits. And I think that, Mr. Knopf, your suggestion to add a term is okay. That, to me, doesn't solve the fundamental problems with the structure of this, but it certainly puts a limit. Of course, we could always go back and change that limit in a future legislative session. So I just think that what we're building here is a subsidization structure that would fund projects without really having an opportunity to determine whether or not they're actually successful. So I would move that we strike subdivision 7 and line 6.16 after the comma and to the end of that paragraph, subdivision 6.
All right. Senator Hahn moves an amendment to the amendment. Senator Dibble?
Madam Chair, I would not support that. I think that would take away the crux of the bill, which is allowing local units of government some assurance. I don't think this is a subsidy. They'll be paying back the money, but it's assurance that they can enter into a lease purchase sort of financing arrangement, which is, as Mr. DeFeber articulated, comes off the operating side. It simply extends the terms if the savings weren't as great as anticipated, so that their positive cash flow is maintained. It's a simple idea, and I don't think it's great exposure. And like I said earlier, if something is really out of whack, that would come to light fairly quickly, and a plan for remediation and taking another look at what's going on would be implemented immediately.
Members, on this amendment, I think it's appropriate time to comment on the process here. My intention is to hold on to these bills that we have in front of the Finance Division as we go through our budgeting process, because there's a number of different bills that we'll be seeing, some of which ask for general fund dollars, some of which ask for funds from other accounts, and we need to have all of those in front of us as we put together our budget recommendations. I'm not sure which one Senator Cohen will want to have in his finance bill, for example. So I think it's premature for us to be making any decisions right now about whether how much money would be needed for this bill. So I would argue that we shouldn't be adopting Senator Hahn's amendment, because that would – I think we need to leave this as is. And then when we discuss this bill in relationship to the other bills that the committee will be looking at, we can make a decision about what funding is available to help with the different ideas we have in front of us. Any other discussion on the Senator Hahn's motion?
More technical changes, too, but we can do that.
Okay. Mr. Knopf says we'd need perhaps some technical changes to implement your proposal, Senator Hahn, if it prevails. So let's vote on Senator Hahn's motion as proposed by Senator Hahn, knowing that we could make technical fixes if needed. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no?
No.
Okay. Motion does not prevail. Let's vote on the delete all amendment as amended, as offered by Senator Torres-Ray to Senator Dibble's bill. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no?
No.
Motion prevails. All right. Is there, as I mentioned, I'm going to just lay the bill over for further consideration as we put together our budget recommendations. But let me ask if there's any other comments, Senator Dibble, from you or any witnesses?
Not for myself, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Okay. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on Senate File 3096? Oh, and I should mention, the other thing I forgot to say about the budget is that I believe the governor has recommended this allocation in his budget proposal, that he's recommending funding this, just for people's information.
Say, mark that down.
Mark that down.
just come back. Just that the governor and I are bringing something forward. We've done
hand,
it a few times before, and
side.
All good things happen when we work together, the governor and I. So
that's true. All right. Well, come back and remind us next week when we're putting our budget recommendations together, Senator Dibble, and we'll welcome that conversation in the next few days. All right. Senate File 3096 will be laid on the table for further consideration.
Thank you
so
Madam
much,
Chair,
Senator
members.
Dibble. All right, Senator Rosen, you're up. And I was talking with the fiscal analyst trying to compare these two bills, and I guess Senator Dibble's bill would provide private financing for public building improvements, and your bill would provide public funding for private building, the kind of the opposite. Is that true?
Madam Chair, more renewable. But if you would allow me, Madam Chair, I should have worn my tennis shoes. I could have beat Senator Dibble by 27 seconds.
We were actually waiting and killing time waiting for either one of you. So whoever got here first, we wanted to grab him. Senator Rosen.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I have before you Senate File 2949, and I do have a handout here. And apparently, there is a handout up there that needs to be. But this Senate file is a micro energy loan program, which would authorize $20 million in state revenue bonds and appropriate these proceeds from the sale of these bonds to make long-term, low-interest loans to local units of governments. And these would support community and neighborhood projects and provide financial assistance to individual homes and business owners to install technologies specifically dealing with solar, wind, geothermal, biogas, and microhydro. Madam Chair, before I get started a little farther, I have the A1 amendment.
Okay, the A1 amendment, it's coming around. And is this is not the first committee either for this bill, correct? So we'll have to discuss that.
That's right, Madam Chair. This bill has been through energy. And these were the recommendations that came out of that committee that you sit on and Senator Rummel sits on. And basically the amendment would allow to piggyback on the back of loans from the Housing Authority. That's one of the areas. And it would also let me just get my notes here real quick. It would also broaden the different government entities that would be eligible for these loans, and also it would broaden the selection criteria for these loans.
Okay.
So, Madam Chair, before I turn it over to the testifiers, last year, as you know, we had the Year of the Energy in 07 with our RES and our Conservation Improvement Program and our greenhouse gas emissions, and because of those wonderful initiatives that we passed in the state, the Next Gen Energy Board that, Madam Chair, both you and I sit on, was initiated by the governor and the legislature. And what's being passed out is the Next Gen Energy Board strategic vision. And I think, actually, Senator Dibble's bill and this bill, Senate File 2949, fits very well into the vision of the Next Gen Energy Board about where we're taking our energy vision, promoting the next generation of biofuels. So to recap the technologies that are in this bill that would be available for these long-term low-interest loans would be solar thermal water heating, solar electric, small wind up to 250 kilowatts, geothermal heat pump, anaerobic digestion gas, and microhydro system up to 700 kilowatts. Excuse me, 100 kilowatts. That's a typo. Excuse me, that's a big deal. The criteria for the loans would be they would have to be dispensed geographically throughout the state. There'd have to be a diversity of technology. There'd have to be this integration with the Conservation Energy Efficiency Program with the local utilities and natural gas utilities serving the area. There'd have to be reliability and cost-effectiveness of this technology and the resources. We address the total life cycle energy use and greenhouse emissions reductions per dollar installed of the cost, total percentage of the project cost requested, and also the proposed security for the payback of the loan would be in this criteria. The loan must be issued at the lowest interest required to recover the cost of issuing the loan, and a minimum of 15 years unless a shorter term is necessary to attract the bond purchasers. And these bond proceeds are credited into a special local renewable energy initiative renew revenue bond proceeds account. And we talked about shortening that account. But with that, Madam Chair, I have Mr. Mike Bull with me that could clarify anything.
All right. Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Bull.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Mike Bull with the Office of Energy Security. And I think a couple things that to note up front. One is that the risks, you know, with the previous bill, which we obviously do support, the risks are shared amongst the participants, in the, including the state, and we have some money involved in that. With this proposal, the risk is really shared between the bondholders, you know, with the sale of these revenue bonds, the risk is shared between the bondholders and the loan, the local units of government and the folks who are participating in the loan. So that in this proposal, the state doesn't have a role in sharing the risk. It's really those entities that are between the folks who are buying the revenue bonds and the folks who are participating in the loans. So that's one example. The other focus of this bill is that it's on these small micro-energy, renewable energy installations, whereas the previous bill was focused primarily, for the most part, they're going to be energy efficiency improvements with some cost-effective renewable integrated in with it. This is primary. This is entirely focused on addressing the clamor that I think we've all heard for folks who want to have help with solar panels on their homes, help with anaerobic digesters on their farms, you know, these kinds of geothermal for their buildings. We're trying to figure out these financing mechanisms that will help get these kinds of technologies out into the field and deployed. As Senator Rosen pointed out, what we have done with the amendment is collected the recommendations that we'd heard as the bills are going through the various committees in the House and Senate, and have put them together in a single amendment. So we want to coordinate where possible with the Housing Finance Authority loans that they make to directly to residential facilities, as well as to broaden the types of public entities that could participate in a loan program to include housing redevelopment authorities, economic development authorities, port authorities, and such, that those folks may also want to be have told us they'd be interested in participating potentially in a program like this.
All right. Thank
Madam
you.
Chair, and along with the counties, cities, towns, sanitary districts, and the Metropolitan Council would also be eligible for this, along with the EDAs, the Housing Authority, and the Port Authority.
So they'd be eligible to issue bonds or to use the
No, proceeds? to receive the loan.
So it's not just for private
The Commissioner of Finance issues the bonds.
So it could be any kind of local, public or private entity could make use of these loan funds.
Right.
Or could enter into a loan.
Let me be maybe more clear of the mechanics. We would we're asking for the authority to issue state revenue bonds for this purpose. We would then, on a yearly basis, we would set out an RFP asking for local units, the types of entities that we're identifying here, who would be interested in participating in a loan like this. We would then, based on that level of interest, we would go to work with the Commissioner of Finance to actually go to the bond markets and see what interest there is out there for the sale of those bonds, and try to match these up so that We put then from the sale of those bonds, we would then select the proposals from the local units who'd want to participate in this program and get the money out to them and let them work in their jurisdictions and get that these technologies installed. That's the primary vision. The other one is that we would also work with the Housing Finance Authority through their existing loan mechanisms for residential homeowners and to participate in those loans to get these most of those loans are for renovations of existing homes, construction of new homes, and we would work to participate in those programs to get these kinds of technologies installed where the homeowner wants to take on that additional loan amount.
Okay. Mr. DeFebra, is there anything you wanted to say?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, I'm just here to keep an eye on Mr. Bull.
Okay, good job.
There's a whole bunch of folks.
And I see Mr. Johnson nodding his head. Did you want to say anything on this bill?
Madam Chair, members, I can be extremely brief. I know you've had a long afternoon already on this. So Craig Johnson, League of Minnesota Cities again, and similarly to the last bill, this is a very useful program for local governments. It is voluntary. It provides a mechanism not only for getting renewable energy projects on public buildings where there's a very high demand, but for setting up potential economic development programs locally that could help other private members of the community that are also interested in moving forward in those directions and where the program might be best served through a local authority to do that.
So, Mr. Johnson, do local units of government already have the authority to do this, to issue these bonds?
Madam Chair, I don't know off the top of my head. It would be very challenging because it would typically be a very small amount that a local unit would be seeking, and revenue bond markets are a tough place to play if you're not carrying a fairly large load of money.
Okay, so part of the benefit is the pooling of all of this together?
Madam Chair, absolutely.
And can you, whoever wants to, just talk about the risk issue that we had so much conversation about in the other bill. So, as you said, Mr. Bull, it would be shared between the bond issuer and the whoever is taking out the loan. So what happens if it's not cost-effective? I mean, if I'm a homeowner, I borrow some money to put solar panels on my home. Well, first of all, how would that be paid back? Is that, I heard some talk about putting this on property tax statements. Is that what you're talking about doing, or is that, do you decide in this bill? And what happens if it's not cost-effective, if they don't work, if, you know, they lose their job and can't pay? How does that work? Who has the, bears the risk here?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think on the residential applications, I would go through Housing Finance Agency. I believe there most of these loans would pass the threshold where that would require to be a secured loan. So it would be a second mortgage. Obviously, there is some risk in that market, and that would have to be calculated in how those loans are priced in order to look at what a standard default rate would be. And they've been in that business for a very long time and are very good at that, which is one of the reasons why we wanted to work through them, because they have a very well-developed program approach that provides sort of the cradle-to-grave origination and servicing throughout the state. As far as on the local government side on revenue bonds, they're not a moral obligation or a full faith and credit obligation of the state. We would, again, in looking at loan applications, look at how an applicant proposes to secure the loan as one of the criteria in ranking applications. I would look at a high quality security as being allowing us to access state aids payments if they were not to make a payment on the loan, for instance, as a contractual agreement. There may be other approaches too, but we would be looking at as one of the deciding points on whether we would approve an application, how well secured it is.
So you'd be negotiating with local governments to figure out how to ensure that they're going to pay these back, and basically it would come out of their budget. So the local governments would take the risk here, essentially, and their local taxpayers, rather than the state taxpayers.
I'm sure that's correct.
On the homeowners, what's the benefit to a homeowner? These are lower interest than you can get anywhere else. Is that the difference? In terms of why would they go to the MHFA for one of these loans rather than just going to their local bank, for example?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, they're below market rate. The rate that the revenue bonds would carry would be below a standard market rate.
Plus, Madam Chair,
Senator Rosen.
I think for the local homeowner, too, they would be in communication with the Economic Development Authority. The EDA, or with the county officials, city officials, and that communication can only benefit projects like this, where everybody's on the same page. You and I worked on that ethanol plant, Madam Chair, down in Winnebago, mm-hmm. and just last weekend there was a nice article. Of course, this would not apply to this, but this is trying to frame it up to the type of thinking that's out there in Greater Minnesota. Towards, and this would apply to all of Minnesota, not just to Greater Minnesota, but type of thinking when it comes to renewable projects. And so they put two wind turbines on an ethanol plant, the first ever in the whole nation to have a renewable supplying a renewable for their energy, part of their energy needs. And now they're microwaving the byproduct for more energy in this fluid bed. It's just a fascinating story, and I should send you that article, Madam Chair. But that just sums up. It's from an individual, a local farmer, who thought of all this and got the financing going and worked with Senator Anderson and I to make sure that this legislation was passed. And that's the type of thinking that is out there, because we have set the standard very high and very aggressive but very attainable. Towards our renewable energy standards, and people are thinking in that. The resources are there, obviously, so we want to make sure that all these entities are working together, and that's why I think this bill is so creative and so important.
Do you have any way of estimating how much you think will be, how much renewable energy will be put into operation as a result of this bill? I mean, any way of guessing?
Madam Chair,
just frankly, no. What we're looking to try to do, I think, well, there are a lot of ideas floating around. You've heard, you know, the previous bill there in Senator Pretner Solon's committee. We've had a lot of discussions. You've had a lot of discussion about the Senator Rummel's proposal. Senator Dahl has a proposal that we'll be discussing today. There's a lot of ways that we're trying to develop a menu of choices, a menu of things that we can do to get more of these kinds of technologies installed. And so that's really what we're trying to do, is to provide another avenue, another menu choice to try to support the development of these kinds of technologies.
Madam Chair, I do believe that the Next Gen Energy Board will probably be seeing many of these projects and learning about a lot of these projects coming across the table, and we need to facilitate that movement.
Mm-hmm. So just one more question. The state revenue bonds, you're requesting authorization for $20 million in state revenue bonds? I'm looking for that number in here somewhere.
Yep.
It must
right.
be at the end. Okay. And how would that be divided up among the different purposes?
We haven't settled on that. Partly will be that we've, in our conversations with MHFA, we've been focused entirely on the mechanics of how to make sure that we can participate and enhance the loans that they've had. But we haven't quite got to the level of divvying it up yet. Partly is getting a sense from local units level of interest that they want to be to participate in a program like this. So we have some estimates about how we would over time divvy up that $20 million, but not within the two purposes. In our fiscal note, I think we were thinking about it in terms of starting somewhat small, $4 million for the first go around, and then building on that and sort of perfecting the mechanism and the payback.
So So how did you come up with $20 million as a starting point? And you must be able to translate that into a number of projects out there at least.
Madam Chair, partly we could develop a bunch of assumptions, and we would do that for you if you'd like us to. The issue, though, is there are a lot of dynamics involved about federal money that may be involved, private money, people, how much do they want to put up? So there's what we're talking about is cost sharing to a large extent around these kinds of technologies, and we can develop a set of assumptions if that would be helpful to you, and provide that to you.
Sure, that would be great. That would be helpful. I'm just trying to think again about. I think this is a great idea. I'm just trying to understand if I were a homeowner. I am a homeowner. If I were a homeowner who wanted to put solar on my home, which I do, actually, but first I have to get new windows and insulation and a high-efficiency furnace, which is coming first. So, for example, how would you – I mean, the whole lease purchase idea that's in Senator Dibble's bill offers a way of sort of paying for this in a really convenient way that you – I mean, I suppose for a homeowner, you'd have to work that out with your utility to try to pay it off through your energy bill every month. But under this program, it would just be basically a home equity loan, and you just have to pay it off. How does that compare in terms of cost? It's the same idea, isn't it? It's in the end, it's just who you're writing a check to.
Madam Chair, I think one way to think about it might be that under the Senator Dibble's bill, primarily those are going to be energy conservation improvements that will have actual energy savings, that will have actual bottom line reductions in energy costs. So, and which is why we think it's appropriate for us to share in the risk of that. We think that that's a good that's something that we can see our way clear to participate in. This is more of a straight. We're trying to provide resources at a lower than market rate, a loan program where if somebody wants to, and there's a lot of people that want to put solar panels on their home, who want to put small wind in their on their farms, and try to provide that sort of facilitate that arrangement through a state revenue bond appropriation.
And there's no payback requirement. I mean, of a certain amount of time, no cost effectiveness requirement. Did you say minimum of 15 years loan?
Madam Chair, there's a loan
maximum
period that would have to be where it would have to be paid. The loan would have to be paid back, and it was uh-huh. within a certain time period. What we'd be look, we would look at cost effectiveness in greenhouse gas emissions per dollar, et cetera, in terms of the ranking of the proposals that we get from local units, so that as we figure out how to, we have so much, you know, the bond market is interested in participating at X level. We match that against what the local units have proposed to us, and we want to rank those based on certain criteria, cost effectiveness and greenhouse gas emissions per dollar participated. Those are some of the criteria which we would use to rank the proposals.
All right, any other questions? Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you give me an idea of the criteria for developing this loans and who is eligible? So in the case of Senator Anderson, for instance, who wants to have a solar panel, who will be eligible to apply for this? How do we ensure that people who cannot afford to do this would benefit first, or how do you establish criteria?
Madam Chair, Senator Torres Ray, for the average homeowner, for the low-income homeowner, that's the primary reason to work through the Minnesota Housing Finance Authority programs. Those programs are generally they have an income limit, so they're targeting the mid to lower class, economic stratus to try to get opportunities to that community. So that's one avenue to try to get to those folks. The other is that we'll be working with the loans directly to local units of government, and they can decide how to use those loan proceeds, whether to do improvements, renewable energy installations on their public buildings or within a business park within the area, or so we want them to be able to have the flexibility to design their own program that fits with the using these loan proceeds that fits their jurisdiction, the kinds of things in their communities that their communities are asking for, rather than a one-size-fits-all program out of St. Paul. I live in Northfield. There's a tremendous not that we're directing any of this money to Northfield. In that community, there's lots and lots and lots of interest about how to do renewable energy installations to make essentially Northfield energy sufficient. I don't know if we'll ever get to that level, but the idea would be to try to find the new and different ways to help support the installation and the movement toward that vision for my community as well as all of yours.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Senator Torres-Ray, the potential on these with our animal production and the methane digesters and what we can do there, it's tremendous. And you complement that with a wind turbine. You've got some real renewable energy agenda. We're really moving, so.
Senator Chaudhry.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And building on that question, tell me how you arrived at the local unit of government step, grant step. Why not just say, here's a loan program. If an individual wants to apply, let them. If a company wants to apply, let them. If a municipality wants to apply, let them.
Mr. Bull.
Madam Chair, Senator Chaudhry, a couple of steps to that process. One is that we think that there are going to be a lot of different ways that people are going to want to use these dollars, that we wanted to be allow them to design the local units to be able to design programs that fit their jurisdictions. Senator Rosen just mentioned that there are farm communities that are going to be want to focused around certain kinds of installations. Because the local units are under some stresses, I think Craig might mention, to be able to be responsive to their constituents as well, to be able to get some assistance in these kinds of programs. The other thing is that it's a lot easier on the state, frankly, to administer programs directly with sort of wholesale the loan to the local unit rather than administer a plethora of loans out to a whole bunch of folks. So it's an administration question.
Madam Chair.
Senator Chaudhry.
There might be a policy benefit, too. It would force a local unit of government kind of get their energy act together and come up with a plan.
Communicate.
And if they don't, then they can just distribute it to individuals.
Well, there won't be enough to go around. This is probably... but so those that are the most motivated and organized, I assume, will be getting the money here.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you. I think this has been a really thoughtful discussion on both these bills. I appreciate members' questions. We need to move on the amendment. You can't move the amendment. Yeah. Ms. Doyle.
I have a technical correction,
yes,
Madam
please.
Chair.
I'm sorry. I'm just teasing. Yes.
After line 1.4 after...
On the amendment?
On the amendment. We'd like to insert page 1, comma, delete lines 10 to 14. Right now, the amendment does not delete lines 10 to 14, and it was intended to delete those as well.
All right. Is that fit with you, Senator Rosen?
Yes. Thank you.
All right. We'll incorporate that into the A1 amendment. Would someone move the A1 amendment? Senator Chaudhry moves the A1 amendment. On that, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. All right. We're going to lay Senate File 2949 as amended on the table for further consideration by this committee. And members, I wanted to announce next week, as I mentioned, thank you very much, Senator Rosen, and testifiers. We have a lot of work to do next week, so we're definitely going to be meeting our normal committee out days, Tuesday and Thursday. We may have to add an extra meeting. We have at least 10 more bills to hear. It'd be great to get them to consider all of those before that finance deadline, although They may or may not have to fall under that. We're not sure yet. And so just stay tuned for the schedule. And I also wanted to announce that the zoo animals from the Minnesota Zoo are in the rotunda, so you're invited to go visit them on your way back to your offices. And everyone have a wonderful weekend, holiday weekend.
Did they bring the gorilla? Oh, no, that's Como.
And the polar bear, yeah. That's Como. The meeting's adjourned.